I'm Lillian Vasquez with Lifestyles on KVCR. Thanks for listening. On today's show, I'll speak with author and educator Sari Fordham. Sari is an English professor at La Sierra University, but today we'll be talking about her book, Wait for God to Notice. Her book shares her family's life living in Uganda. We'll talk about the challenges and the beauty of her childhood experiences living in Uganda with her parents and her sister. The book is a love letter to her mother. Welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, your father was offered the opportunity to teach in Uganda. That's what got you there. What kept your family there?
Wow, that is a great question. I think what kept us there was my father's commitment to his students and the fact that the Seventh-day Adventist Church, where my father was teaching for at the university, they kept the program going. And so as long as the school was in Uganda, my father didn't feel comfortable moving his family. Despite how dangerous it was, he felt like if other people are there, then we should also stay.
Well, dangerous is kind of what I would describe that as. Based on the many challenges and circumstances that you faced, was there the option to leave at any time?
Well, that's a really good question. My father consistently let my mom know that if she felt uncomfortable, she could take my sister and I and go and stay with her family in Finland. But it wasn't quite as simple as that because finances were certainly a question for us. And traveling in and out of Uganda was very difficult. So while our family could technically leave when we wanted to, we generally stayed right up until we fled Uganda on the train, and then we returned. So we did occasionally, if we traveled to Finland, my mother would keep us there longer, except when my grandmother died, we didn't take trips out of the country usually.
So I didn't feel when reading the book that you really had the option to go, but it did exist, okay. I want you to talk about some of the challenges your family faced, and one of them was the abundance of snakes you described in the book. It was as if Medusa lived in our attic. Will you share how your mom tried to combat the snakes?
So my mom had grown up in Finland where they just have one snake and it's not terribly venomous. So she didn't have a lot of context on poisonous snakes. So then she moved into the house that was a mini habitat. We lived in a house that was surrounded by a jungle in Uganda and had a really vibrant wildlife population. And what it looked like for us was a large variety of snakes. The house on the hill and the jungle surrounding our house were really infamous even with the Ugandan students. And when I returned to Uganda, as an adult, one of the first things people said about my growing up is, oh, you grew up on Snake Hill. And so when we arrived, my mom discovered that there were a lot of snakes there. So we would commonly see mambas or cobras, pythons, vipers certainly. But even though a viper is a poisonous snake, they were not as dangerous as compared to the green and black mambas that we would, you know, encounter. So it was considered a more gentle snake experience. So, of course, my dad had a very dramatic viper encounter. But yeah, so my mom was like terrified of snakes. And so when I grew up, the one thing I heard a lot from my mom was how to manage snakes. When I was out, I should be singing and making noise so that they could hear me and leave me alone. And if I did see one, I was told repeatedly that I shouldn't move. And if I came home and I had any like scratch on my arm or leg, my mom was always asking me, was it a snake bite? Which of course, you know, if it were, I wouldn't be home. So certainly snakes were a large part of my childhood. And now I find them incredibly fascinating. But my mother was very successful when I was younger to help me respect our neighbors.
But she did at one time cut down some trees with the thought that they wouldn't be falling into your home, right?
Yes, she did. So when we first came there, she cut a lot of the branches around our house, which ended up putting us in a more dangerous position because the snakes ended up going into places instead of those trees that would cause problems for us. But her big kind of mantra was to be proactive. So you might not do the right thing, but you're at least doing something. And I think that kind of idea really helped her while we were in Uganda and then later Kenya, was that if there's a problem and you're concerned about something, you at least do something.
And so she did.
How
old were you and your sister when you first moved there?
I was a little younger than two. And then when we moved to the United States, I was 10 years old. So I spent 8 years, a little over 8 years, in and out of Uganda and Kenya.
You got sick a couple of times while you were there. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, malaria is very common in East Africa. And I wrote a couple times about being sick, but the reality is that we got malaria as regularly as two or three times a year. It was very hard to avoid mosquitoes. My father and I were the two members of our family who got it the most often, though I remember once when my mother had malaria. She was so sick when she was trying to take care of us that she was crawling around the house because she couldn't walk. Malaria will really knock you out when you get it. I also got an illness shortly after we arrived in Uganda. It was never diagnosed. My parents were able to get me to the hospital and they did a lot of tests, but they were not able to figure out what I had. And at that point, the doctors didn't think I was going to survive. My fever was so high, they couldn't figure out what it was. They didn't want to keep me in the hospital because they didn't know what I had. They didn't want serious illness creating problems in the hospital. So they sent me home and they told my parents, all you can do is pray now. And so as missionaries, my parents should have, you know, taken this as maybe comforting. But of course, they were parents. And so they very much knew the message that the medical doctors and the nurses, they didn't have a lot of hope for me. So my parents did take me home, and I did manage to pull through, obviously, since I'm here today. And I still don't know what I had. I ended up losing all my hair and the fever, and I was ill for quite a while, even after I started getting better. What that was, I don't know, but the malaria at least was treatable. We could take chloroquine or we could get a shot of chloroquine when we got malaria. The treatment wasn't always immediately effective because it's hard to get the right doses and it's hard to keep chloroquine down. But malaria is so dangerous, is really unfortunate because it is a treatable illness, but there's so many barriers sometimes for families getting
right.
their kids treatment.
And you mentioned it, like malaria is how we get the common cold over here. So there is treatment to it, and I'd be freaked out, but you know, your mom got through a lot in that time there. Let me reintroduce our guest is Sari Fordham, author and English professor at La Sierra University. Her book is Wait for God to Notice. You write in the book, the roads might be worn down, but the terrain was starkly beautiful. There is no land as lovely as Uganda. If you drive long enough, you begin to hear its music. What music do you hear? What are you talking about here?
Wow. Like, my whole body can hear the music of Uganda when I'm there. When I returned as an adult the first time, I stepped out of the Entebbe airport and I felt alive in a way that I hadn't felt in years. There was a distinct memory of home that spoke to me. And just listening to the insects when I stepped out of the airport that first time and feeling the very distinct humidity and smelling the air, there was a music of home that is hard to explain because I have moved all my life. I've now lived in Riverside, California for almost 15 years, which is the longest I've lived anywhere, and it's crazy to me. But before then, I was moving a lot, and when I thought of home, I always saw the red roads of Uganda. I felt the music of the insects, the laughter of my friends, the running down to the dairy and collecting milk. That all was deeply embedded into my being, watching monkeys from our veranda, you know, squatting down and watching driver ants stream across the road, which just endlessly fascinates me. These things have shaped me in really profound ways. And then one day they were all gone, and they were gone for a really long time until I returned to Uganda as an adult before I started writing this book. But in many ways, this call to write this book was both a love letter to my mother, who I was so fascinated to learn so many things about her as I was writing, but also this question of where is home and can you return to home? And so as writing the book, a real important part of writing the book was trying to create the textures of Uganda and the memories I have there so that when the reader is reading the book, they can maybe hear that music as well.
Your mother, at times, clearly questioned her decision to support your father's decision to live in Uganda. Did you as a child or now as an adult ever question your mom's decision to be there with her girls?
No. That is a fantastic question. I've been asked, how I felt about my father staying. It felt like there was only one option, really, even though there was a time she was considering what she would do. But also, I can't imagine any other childhood than the one I had in Uganda. We were there, during a horrific time politically. And yet our childhood in some ways was so idyllic because we were way away from our day-to-day lives. We're way far away from the political happenings for my sister and I. And to grow up and to have the bats swooping through your house, pet chameleons, watching monkeys jumping from branch to branch, that is, I couldn't imagine having a different childhood. So it's really hard for me to imagine my mother making different decisions. And she was such a loyal person. I can't fathom her deciding to do anything. She wasn't obviously always pleased to stay. But when things got really bad and my parents were arguing about what to do, my father would frequently tell her, "You can take the girls and go to Finland." And she would say, "I can't leave you." She knew that without her there, he would take more risks. And so she wanted to do what she could to protect him as well.
So at times when reading the book, I kind of felt like your father was selfish to what he was doing. So did you ever feel your father chose his ministry and his teachings over that of his wife and daughters?
I didn't, because my dad was so fully present when he was there. I understand his reluctance to prioritize his privilege to leave when he knew that his students couldn't. If the school closed and he left, his students wouldn't be able to complete their education. He wasn't sure when they would go. Now, I would have made a different decision than my father. I have a daughter now who's 7 years old, and I wouldn't stay in a country that was as dangerous as Uganda was when we were there. But I do understand where he came from. And I would say that, my memories from my childhood were so vivid with my father's full attention, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
My mother's experience was that he was always gone.
Right.
But my experience was that when he was home, he would get down under the dining room table with us and push matchbox cars. He would tell us stories. He has an ability, which I think was incredibly appreciated by Ugandans who value someone who will take time with you. He has an ability to take a moment as the only moment and not think about the next thing he needs to do or the next thing he needs to do. So when he was present with us, he was so fully and completely present with us that it felt like he was very attentive to our needs. I will say, though, that when we traveled, the assumption always was that we were going to go with my mother. So when my parents made different travel decisions, like my mother would leave early for Finland, she wasn't going to leave us in Uganda. And no matter how present my father was, I write in the book about how my mom was the comet and we were her tail. We were always going to be wherever my mother was.
Yeah, she was definitely Mama Bear for sure. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'll continue my conversation with author and professor Sari Fordham. You're listening to Lifestyles. I'm Lillian Vasquez. We'll be right back. If you're just joining us, my guest is professor and author Sari Fordham. She teaches at La Sierra University, and we're talking today about her book, Wait for God to Notice. It's about her young life living in Uganda. Your mother was Finnish, and at one point in the book, she uses her Finnish citizenship to get out of a precarious situation. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Yes. That was probably one of her favorite stories to tell later on. The great irony is that my father was foolhardy and brave and willing to move into any reckless situation. But my mother was the one who had all of the most dangerous experiences. My father always happened not to be there. And so when my father was out of the country, Jimmy Carter had his first political crisis. Jimmy Carter said something in a press conference which upset Idi Amin, and he placed all Americans under house arrest. With my father being gone, my sister and I were probably the youngest Americans in Uganda that didn't have a legal guardian. And there were no other Americans that were teaching at the school that my father taught at. And so my mother first thought, well, maybe nobody knows we're here. But it wasn't long until the soldiers came up the hill. And so my mother used her Finnish passport to make sure that the soldiers came to inventory our belongings, which let us know that we were either going to be deported or executed. And the chances are it would have been a deportation. There weren't that many foreigners that were being executed at the time. But that possibility still existed. Even if it's a small one, it's still an appalling possibility.
Yeah.
But my mom was really mad. She grew up poor, and so she was really angry when the soldiers came, and she realized that everything that we had was going to be gone. We would owe nothing. We would, if best case scenario, we would be kicked out of the country with a small suitcase.
Definitely not with your lazy boy, right?
Right, right, right. And she loved that lazy boy. Because the school had shipped some of our belongings from the state, and some of the belongings in our house belonged to the school. So the soldier wanted to figure out what belonged to us and what belonged to the school. And my mother had a different agenda, and it just came to her. And so while the soldier was there, she decided that she was going to claim every single item that we owned, up to my father's bicycle, which was actually incredibly valuable. You know, one could get killed for less than a bicycle. So my mother claimed my father's bicycle as her own. I was not there when she was going around and claiming everything, but I can almost feel in my body the fury that she felt and the kind of fear and the uncertainty. What am I going to do? And you can't, you know, internet didn't exist. She couldn't, you know, text my dad or email my dad. And we didn't have a phone, so she couldn't call my father either. So she had to make a decision about how she was going to handle this house arrest. And my father, who never took anything terribly seriously, was so concerned that he went to the Finnish embassy, and they were in the process of making us fabricated Finnish passports, which would be sent to our house via diplomatic pouch to get us out of the country. So my dad did have a plan in mind. However, when the house arrest was dropped, my father came home. My mother said, "So we're leaving now?" And my dad said, "Why? Why would we leave?"
Yeah, you got us out of that jam. Why would we leave? Let's face whatever is before us now. And
yeah,
she said,
"The worst has happened and we're fine. Why make a mountain out of a molehill?"
Yeah, that seemed constant in his rationale. Wait for God to Notice is the title of your book. I did see a couple of times of references in the book related to your mom's thoughts or comments. Why was this the phrase you used to title the book?
So what was invaluable to me as I was writing the book was my mother's letters. Many of them were written in English. They were written to my American grandmother, and many of them were written in Finnish, and I had a friend translate them. And one of them that was translated was when my mother writes her father about As bad as things were politically, also women have to deal with kitchen table issues. Anyone who went through the pandemic knows how much, like, the toilet paper shortage was on everyone's mind. And so my mother wrote this in a letter. "We just found out that the price of one roll of toilet paper is $5, and its size is not enough to use a dozen times. I've read that the sellers rarely have bananas and beans. Wait for God to notice. We remember you all with love in our prayers." And it so struck me, my mother's line there about waiting for God to notice the indignity of Ugandan women who weren't able to buy food for their family or who couldn't afford toilet paper. $5, she was talking about U.S. dollars. And so that meant toilet paper was off the table for most people. And including us, I have no idea how we managed, because there's no way our family had enough money for $5 rolls of toilet paper. Those little indignities on top of the violence and the disappearing people and the bodies that are showing up. My mother was so angry with God. How can this be happening without God noticing? How is this inequality and injustice allowed? And my father's answer to that question was, you know, his responsibility to stay and change things. He liked to say that his job as a missionary was to train his students so that all the missionaries would be kicked out of Uganda and Ugandans would be running the, you know, the country and the schools and everything else. He had a real belief in the value of education and the importance of empowering his students to be the future leaders. And I will say, when I went to Uganda as an adult, I was really pleased to discover that the principal of the school my father helped start was one of my father's former students.
Yeah, that was a nice full circle there.
Yeah. And they were living in our house on the hill, which is obviously not our house on the hill. But, you know, your first house will always be yours in your heart.
Absolutely.
But my mother's line, "Wait for God to notice," really struck me as saying something important about the silence of God sometimes when there's injustice.
I always ask an author, you know, why did you write this book? You kind of said it was a tribute to your mom or a love letter acknowledging your mom. And so is that why you wrote the book?
My mother died when I was 24 or 25 years old. It's not a spoiler because it's mentioned early in the book. And when she died, I again felt unmoored in ways that leaving Kenya and Uganda had. And that was really what got me, like, emotionally thinking about where is home. A year after she died, I ended up returning to Uganda and working there for an NGO for a while. But it was too hard to be in Uganda without my mom. But that question of where is home became really urgent, because in many ways, home was my family, but now my family didn't look the same way. I didn't have a mother anymore. And so there was that kind of question that was low-key. I didn't start writing right then, but I felt this, like, urgency to understand home and family and who my mother was. Much later, when I visited my aunt in Finland, she gave me this stack of letters that were my mother's words, but my mother's tongue, I literally cannot read. And I held all of my mother's letters, and they were telling me, you know, these were the letters she wrote from Uganda, and each one was, you know, saying, "We're still here, we're still here." Well, she, of course, was not still here. And that kind of, that draw, that pull, that curiosity, I wanted to know what was in those letters. And I also wanted to understand who my mother was and what being in Uganda meant to her. And where was home for me as an adult? And so all of these various questions kind of drew me into this story and this book about, you know, growing up in Uganda before, during, and after the dictatorship of Idi Amin.
So do you have another book in you, or is it one and done?
Oh, one always has books in them. I have a daughter who's 7 years old, which, of course, in some ways helped the book, because I could understand motherhood in a way that I never could before, but also really slowed down the writing of this book. But it certainly kind of got me interested in questions of motherhood now from the perspective of a mother. I'm an environmental activist, and I'm really kind of concerned about the question of how do you raise a child in a birding world? I just finished the amazing book, Paradise by Lizzie Johnson, talking about the campfire. And, you know, these questions of climate change are so urgent. So my next book is going to be kind of investigating that question of, as a parent, how do you raise a child in a world that is on fire, sometimes literally and sometimes metaphorically. So that's my question. The week my daughter was born, I read an essay by an environmentalist in The Guardian. And he wrote and said, you know, I've been an environmental activist my whole life, but I've come to the conclusion that there's nothing to be done now. Just enjoy the years the planet has left. And I thought, I am holding my 3-day-old baby. This is not okay. And I realized there are different answers to the climate emergency, and I reject any notion of giving up. I think that as a mother, that is not the acceptable answer. So I'm kind of interested in the humor. I know it's not a funny subject, but the humor of trying to be an environmentalist while a working mom, the power of local activism, and actually the hope of what each person can do. The situation is very big and very complicated. I don't want to oversimplify things, but it is not something that we have no ability to respond to as parents or as actually citizens of the United States.
So there is another book in you.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. When this book was done, I was like, I have so many ideas.
Our guest has been Sarah Fordham, author and professor. She's an English professor at La Sierra University and author of Wait for God to Notice. And it sounds like there's more books coming your way. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a treat.
To learn more about Sarah Fordham and her book, Wait for God to Notice, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles and click on Today's Show. That's our show for this week. To hear any of our past shows, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. You can also listen to Lifestyles on iTunes, Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. Search for Lifestyles with Lillian Vasquez on your streaming service and take the show on the go. Thanks to all who helped to make this show possible, including Sharita Wadd, David Fleming, Sean Houlihan, Natasha Coles, and executive producer Rick Dulock. Our theme music is provided by Ethan Bortnick. Join me next week at the same time for Lifestyles with me, Lillian Vasquez. Bye for now.